Welcome to Bedford County Speaks, the region's only locally produced public affairs program. Every Saturday at this time, we speak to people making a difference in Bedford County. Now, here is our host, Lloyd Roach.
Thank you, Matt DeFazio. Good morning to you. Welcome to Bedford County Speaks, a weekly public affairs program over News Talk 98.7 and 1310 WBFD. This morning's program is brought to you as a public service by the Bedford County Development Association, BCDA, presenting the Bedford County Advantage, a future built on opportunity, collaboration, and exceptional quality of life that defines our region. This morning, we're very charmed to have a candidate for the Democratic 13th District of Congress, Beth Farnham. And good morning, Beth. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Lloyd. Thank you for having me here.
We're in the Denim Coffee Shop. I want to give them a plug because they've been very kind to us here. And we've met Ben kind of halfway in Chambersburg. She lives in Adams County, but we met here. So here we are in Chambersburg on this semi-cloudy but spring day. Thank you very much for talking to me today. I appreciate it very much. I try to cover the candidates as early as I can. I have a question for you. In your literature, you said you're a faltering or a bumbling GOP. What made you change?
Well, it's a long and complicated story.
Well, give me the simple version.
The simple version is that I had a baby in 2015, and by February 2016, Trump had landed on my radar. That's how much there was an impact of this. I was seeing him win the primaries. And I turned to my husband and I said, you know, if it ever came down between Trump and Clinton, I think I'm voting for Clinton. And he said, really? He was also a Republican who didn't pay attention much to the issues, as well as a former NRA member. And so I said, yeah. And so that's the two of them won the primaries, and we really researched Clinton and realized she was much more experienced, caring, educated, and she had the integrity that we were looking for in a U.S. president.
So that was your first presidential election where you voted for a Democrat?
I won't say that because when I was a very young voter, I voted for a Democrat because I thought he'd win.
Okay. Well, you must have been a very prescient voter then. Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Tell me about the 13th District. What makes it so special for you?
Oh, thank you very much for asking this question. First of all, it's important to understand the scope of it. It's over 10 counties in South Central Pennsylvania. And so we're talking the basic townships we think about are from Gettysburg to Bedford and from Johnstown to Shippensburg and all of the mountains, farms, and charming small towns in between. Let's not forget Chambersburg and Huntingdon, as well as McConnellsburg and Altoona. But it's got we've got a lot of people who rely on Medicaid benefits, SNAP benefits. We're a district of over 769,000 souls. It is the most conservative congressional district in Pennsylvania, but it is also the most beautiful one.
Well, that it is, and that was kind of getting to my next question. What drives you to do this? You are in, according to the literature I read, the most conservative district in Pennsylvania. It has been controlled by conservative Republicans for decades. What is the hope for you? How do you feel that you can succeed in all of this?
Well, first of all, no matter the history, anyone can vote for the Democrat to represent us in Congress. So it doesn't matter the millions of dollars that other people raise. What matters is how people vote. So I am much more reflective of who we are in our 13th congressional district than our current multimillionaire dermatologist of a representative. I would represent us so much better because we are everyday Americans. I was looking at the median household income for Bedford County. It's about $60,000. You've got over 10,000 people in this district, in the county of Bedford, who rely on Medicaid benefits, and over 6,000 who rely on SNAP. So we are many everyday Americans who send our children to public schools and are just trying to make our way and have our little piece of the American dream. We are not multi-millionaire, ultra-wealthy people doing it.
You bring up an interesting point. I met someone some years ago, Dr. John Mulhern, who was headed up the Fels Institute at the University of Pennsylvania. He studied social and political things from the vantage point of the government. And Dr. Mulhern had a very significant background. He actually worked at the White House once. And we brought up this question. why do we have so much dependency now on the federal government by our citizens? This didn't used to always be. So what would you attribute this? You mentioned the SNAP programs and things like that. And there is a lot of a public assistance in Bedford County. This doesn't sound like a very good thing to me. Is this a good thing for you?
Well, here's the thing. Public assistance is more consistent and reliable than charity. Charity is out of the goodness of our hearts, and it has its place in our society. But when our tax dollars go to helping those in need, first of all, it's an overall good for the community. We want the hungry people fed. We want the sick people healed. So it's not only aligned for the good of the community, it's aligned with my faith, and I believe also with the faith of many of the people in this district. We give our tax dollars to these programs because we want people to be able to have access to the help that they need. Look, like I said, charity's great, but the problem is it's only when people are moved by the spirit or have the circumstances that they can provide through charity. So that kind of giving is not consistent. And so people could go without if they didn't have the federal organization helping it.
Well, Dr. Mulhern's point to me was that the more you do this, the more freedom you extract from the individual. Because how can they be free if they are depending on money from the government?
They are depending on money from the government to see them through the temporary circumstances. Anyone could have an adverse circumstance, whether it be a job loss or often divorce can bring adverse circumstances to people. They could have a medical crisis. And so we want those social safety nets in place to catch them until they are able to be healed and fed enough that they have the stability to be back on their feet and be the workforce we need them to be.
So you think this applies to people that are in multi-generations of this kind of dependency?
Well, first of all, children, because of our wonderful labor laws, children should not be working for a living. They should be dependents who are pursuing their education.
Yeah, but I didn't ask that. I was asking about the dependency of these individuals on welfare and SNAP and things like that over generations, two or three generations of people living on some sort of welfare state.
I think that's really leaning into Reagan's framing of it. There are people who unfortunately are on these programs for dependency, but they do work themselves out of it. So I would not claim that it's multi-generational. I would look at each individual who's in it and ask the question why. Now, I will say this. One of the reasons people are reliant on Medicaid and SNAP benefits is because our federal minimum wage is stuck at $7.25 an hour. It has been stagnating there since 2009, and that is just unconscionable because when we look at that $7.25 an hour and multiply it by 40 hours a week, we're talking full-time, 52 weeks a year, you've still got that single person under the threshold of poverty for the United States, and that's outrageous. Mm-hmm. So I would work to also increase the federal minimum wage, which would decrease the dependency on these kinds of programs.
I wanted to do this interview actually two pieces. I kind of got ahead of myself, but you're doing fine. By the way, you notice I emptied the room. This always happens to me when I do these interviews. There are several people in the room. We started talking, and next thing everybody leaves. It gives me a nice little – makes my studio much more quiet. So anyway.
Well done.
So I promise you we'd have fun. I want to break it into two things. I want to do the local first and then maybe the national.
Sure.
So we're in the first part of the program. We have a few minutes left on that. So let me just kind of pull you into the local thing here, if I may.
Yes, sir.
Constituency service. For many years, I lived in Delaware County. They had a wonderful congressman, regardless of his party,
sure,
that was incredibly good at constituent service. I mean, if you wrote them a letter, you'd get a response in like 5 days. It was that good.
That's
and I
wonderful.
Know that he didn't write it himself, but he had a staff doing it. Is this important to you?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Thank you for asking this incredible question. So one of the feedbacks I get from about our current representative in Congress is that he's not addressing the issues that people raise to him. He's not holding in-person town halls. So first of all, I would be very responsive to the constituents. Now, I'm going to say, with 769,000 souls in this district, not every letter could be personalized, but I would do my darndest to have a paragraph at least that responded to the person's query. These are important, far-reaching, grave issues that touch everyday Americans in the meat and potatoes of our lives, and they should be answered. People are asking serious questions about their health care, their wages, the cost of groceries, and their property taxes, like how they're being affected left, right, and sideways financially. Additionally, we've got voting right being sidelined. So people raise excellent, excellent questions, and they deserve a response. So would I be responding? Absolutely. Would it be a personalized letter? Probably not, but it would directly respond to their queries.
Well, sometimes you would, I would imagine. That's something that really hits you hard.
Well, yeah.
One of the organizations that I am familiar with and I have been involved with over the years are local volunteer fire and EMS. I haven't found a fire company yet, at least in Bedford County, that says they need money and they constantly have to apply for all manner of grants and everything else just to keep the fire trucks running, to keep the ambulances running. And these enterprises have become multi-million dollar operations because of the need for all the sophisticated hardware.
Yes.
Is there anything a congressperson like you could do to assist these organizations, local fire company, local EMS, anybody that's involved in first response?
Well, one of the things that I think is important and impactful to our district is the infrastructure bill. That particular bill was providing things like water and sewer needs and road needs and construction. And so if your roads are in good shape, then you may have fewer vehicular accidents, for example. If your roads are in good shape, they're being attended to with the salt trucks, you know, in the major weather, in major snowstorms. So it's important to recognize that our underlying infrastructure must be maintained properly and to vote for bills such as that, even though our current representative voted against the infrastructure bill. Additionally, those services like EMT and fire absolutely need federal money to be maintained and upgraded. Not one soul should be lost to an emergency situation, and that includes FEMA. We should never cut finances for funding for FEMA, and yet our current representative is supporting these illegal impoundments of FEMA funding.
I haven't heard of this. What kind of is that? The illegal, you call them illegal impoundments?
Congress has power of the purse. Congress decides where money is, our tax dollars are apportioned, and they spell it out in the budget. But what happened was in January of 2025, Trump announced by executive order that he was going to stop funding for a bunch of government services. And the New York Times printed, it was about 2,600 agencies and departments. Now, some of that was not instituted. They did not stop funding for these programs. But Trump, by executive order, was declaring that he was going to stop funding for a bunch of necessary departments and agencies. So that is impounding. That's overstepping the executive power and denying the congressional apportionment of the tax dollars.
Hasn't the Democrats just stopped funding DHS, though, which is one that operates FEMA?
The Democrats did not stop it. They put it to the floor of the House, and at least the House, I believe also the Senate. They can't just unilaterally do that. They need the cooperation of enough Republicans to make that pass. So I believe they delayed in part the funding to the DHS, but it didn't happen by executive branch. It happened absolutely in the U.S. Congress.
I'm involved in a SHARES emergency management program, part of DHS. I got an email from them yesterday saying that they could not function because it is shut down. That's what they said to me.
Can you describe your SHARES?
SHARES is it stands for SHARES HF Radio. It's an HF radio network that is a backup for the emergency services. And they are not going to have any meetings and so forth until the money comes back. So that's the only connection I have to illustrate
okay.
that this is,
gotcha.
In fact,
okay.
in place.
Okay. And I appreciate, I'm sorry you all are suffering
no.
that. And so that's why we have that. And so when you cut away that, yes, it is unfortunate that your program has lost funding temporarily for this. But more importantly, ICE, the Immigration Customs Enforcement, should be corralled, paused, retrained, have contrition for murdering Americans in their streets. They should absolutely follow due process. If they aren't stopped in the manner of what they're doing, even though they were funded billions of dollars through the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, DHS needs to get them under control.
Our brilliant guest is Beth Farnham, and she is speaking to us from the beautiful Denim's Coffee Shop here in Chambersburg. But when we return, we're going to hear more of this from Beth Farnham as Bedford County Speaks continues.
This is Ryan Spring of the Bedford Gazette, and you're listening to Bedford County Speaks on News Talk FM 98.7 and 1310 AM WBFD.
Today's Bedford County Speaks is presented as a public service by the Bedford County Development Association. BCDA President Jen Marsh, along with her professional staff, are building new business, residential, and outdoor recreation opportunities in Bedford County. BCDA builds business parks and fully operational building sites, such as the newly opened Rural Electric Cooperative Operations Center in Business Park 1, or site-ready locations in Business Park 2. In addition to excellent locations for business and industry, BCDA builds relationships that have added millions of dollars and thousands of jobs to Bedford County. BCDA represents a future built on opportunity, collaboration, and the exceptional quality of life that defines our region. To learn more, visit bcda.org.
Bedford County Speaks.
We are back from the very friendly Denim's Coffee Shop. And why am I in Chambersburg? Because Beth Farnham and I decided to meet here, which is sort of kind of halfway. She has come to us from Adams County, and I've come from Bedford County over the two large mountains
That's right.
I drove through this morning in the fog. Beth, before we launch into the Washington thing, I want to talk to you about some local issues that I think are very important, at least in Bedford County. And one of them is gun ownership. You mentioned, I think you said your husband was an NRA member or something.
He's a former one.
We have a lot of gun owners in Bedford County. The Second Amendment is very important to them. So what would you say to these people, for those who want to regulate even more?
I recognize that the Second Amendment is a shall-have amendment. I understand that. However, I also believe in responsible gun ownership. If you look at gunviolencearchive.org, you will see a multitude of gun violence, from gun violence in the streets to gun violence in the schools, in our churches, in our shopping centers. And so we can't just have this unbridled, never check people with guns kind of situation. We need to make sure that gun violence is no longer the leading cause of death for our American children.
Would you agree that at least that it isn't the gun that kills people, it's the people holding the gun? These are shooters, not the weapons.
I'm going to get there.
Okay.
But I want to tell you the type of responsible gun ownership I'm for. Okay. That is safe storage of guns, that is reporting of lost or stolen guns, that is universal background checks for all gun sales, and that is extreme risk protection orders for those who present a risk of harm to themselves or others. If you keep losing them or they keep getting stolen from you, you are not a responsible gun owner. I want people to have guns who are responsible gun owners.
And who determines how they're responsible?
Because it's a shall have, it's mostly going ahead and having the gun unless there is a determining incident in the intervening time.
But who makes that decision?
Well, we do have universal background checks. I think that's really important, including we should have them for the private sales. Because let's face it, these are a lot of the people who've been perpetrating the gun violence. And that includes the universal background checks so that we're not putting it into the hands of violent perpetrators.
I lived in Chicago for a number of years, and Chicago has tremendously restrictive gun laws, and yet it's become the murder capital of the world. If it doesn't work there, why would it work here?
Because it's not consistent. Only Chicago has those rules, and then the surrounding areas don't. Then there's an infiltration other ways.
They have a tremendous amount of murders by gun in Chicago, and they have these restrictive laws against the people of Chicago. So it doesn't appear it works very well there in eastern Illinois.
Well, I would say because it's not consistent across the country. Look at those countries where it's consistently across the country. Let's look at Australia. I'm not saying they never have gun violence, but I'm saying it's way less per capita.
In your notes you gave me, you said something about you want to protect democracy.
Yes, sir.
We are a democratic republic. We're not Vermont, where they have true democracy, where they go in the town meeting and vote on the roads. So what is your definition of this democracy you want to defend?
Our democratic republic is a form of democracy when the people vote. Now, it's true that we're not directly voting for our U.S. president, but in the majority of the states, we're directly voting for the governor, the lieutenant governor, all the state row positions.
We're voting for you.
And right? Voting for me, right. And yeah. U.S. Congress, U.S. Representatives, U.S. senators. So, you know, by the skin of our teeth, it's not a full-on true democracy across the country, but it is a form of democracy. So we will call it that. So it is important that the rights of the people be protected. You know, those revolutionary founders gave us the preamble. Let us not forget, that is the beginning of all the laws that follow in the U.S. Constitution. And it begins by we, the people, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity.
To take this to its end point, does this mean that you will respond to the wishes of people in the 13th District? Your definition of democracy is that you will be reflective of that. So will you make your own decisions or that of your constituents or both?
Oh, that's very interesting. I will be elected to represent the people. I don't know what the issues will be before me, but I will not make some kind of blanket statement or promise that it will always go with the majority, because the majority has a tendency to faction. We learned that from one of the revolutionary founders, James Madison. I am going to have in-person town halls, and I will never vote to take away people's rights and powers. It is unconscionable that John Joyce actually voted for the SAVE Act. This is an act that is basically disparate impact against people, women who take the last names of their spouse, usually a husband. So you've got people who are going to be fighting to show their proof of citizenship when they move or change their name or change their political party, or if they get unjustly removed from the voter rolls to have their driver's license or establish themselves originally on the voter rolls.
Since you're talking about citizenship, let's talk about probably everybody's favorite topic right now, and that is the issue of legal versus illegal aliens. I know several people who have legally immigrated to this country. One of the things that I often think about is if they went through the process of going through all of that, and I know it is quite an arduous process to become a legal immigrant from places, ones I know are from Vietnam, Africa, places like that. How is it fair to them who have done that to admit an illegal alien?
Thank you for bringing this up.
But you understand
I understand the question. Okay. I hear how you framed it.
I'm not to argue whether we should have illegal aliens or not. What I'm recommending is that we should make a discussion between the person who have done it and the persons who refused it.
The majority of people who are considered undocumented immigrants to this country actually came here in a legal way to work for American employers because they got their individual attacker ID number. And so when they got that number, it meant they were cleared to work for American employers in our country. Now, what they did was overstay their visas. And at that point, they are then considered undocumented. But technically, they still have that ITIN. The fact is, we rely on immigrants to pick our fruit in Adams and Franklin counties. We rely on them for construction and hospitality around the district.
This does not answer my fairness question. I'm a legal immigrant. I'm watching people stream over the border from wherever, and they're coming in here to work or whatever they're going to do. And they're saying, well, why do they get a free pass and I don't?
They don't get a free pass. They're here. They got here legally because American employers hired them. And they overstayed their visas, but then we relied on them not only to do the work, but also to pay their taxes. They're paying their state, federal, local, and sales taxes. And so we have a heavy reliance on them. And they've been living here, maybe not with the full paperwork, but it's a misdemeanor at that point. And so if they live here long enough, they might meet the demands to have full citizenship.
So are you saying because we need their labor, it's okay for them to stay here without documents? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that we've been allowing this because we so highly rely on them. And who are these people that you say came here legally and did all the paperwork? Like, are you talking about people from Europe especially?
Well, I mentioned two countries. One was Vietnam. The other was Africa.
Oh, I hadn't heard that.
So I can tell you that from what they told me.
Yeah. What was their experience?
Process. It was long.
Yeah.
And they, in fact, I learned that they probably had to pass a test that probably most American citizens couldn't pass. They had to know more about our government than we ever knew in first or second grade. So it's very interesting. So
well, let me say this: yeah. The undocumented people would get to a point when they prove. They prove residency for X number of years, then they would also have to complete that process. They would be applying for citizenship.
Well, I understand that, but I'm talking about them right now.
They're okay. Here because we need them.
Well, you answered my question. Okay, that's fine. We're here because we need them. Okay. Well, let me just take one more step.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So the border has been insecure in that we've let millions of people in. Should we secure the border?
We don't want people just pouring over the border. We don't want that. We want controlled entry to our country. But we also don't want masked agents of the state going around murdering people or throwing them into detention centers. Look, when you are on U.S. soil, you are automatically under U.S. jurisdiction. That means you are under equal protection of the law, and that means due process. We've got to make it easier to complete the process from coming in as a reliable worker hired by American companies to becoming citizens. You know, interestingly, the Farm Bill is asking for a longer visa because in Pennsylvania, we're number one in the mushroom industry and we're like seventh or eighth in the dairy industry. And so those are year-round industries that rely on immigrant labor. We've got to really look at the process of coming here legally and then completing the process to citizenship, which would also help our demographics. Frankly, we're an aging country. We want these young people in here working, and we want them paying their taxes so that when the rest of us age, our Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and what have you will be there for us, and it will be funded.
You can see she's not a violet on the wall, Beth. Our guest is Beth Farnham. She is the Democratic candidate for Congress in the 13th District. Do you have competition in the Democrat side or not?
Oh, no, no.
So you're running alone?
It's me, but I ran this radio before.
Okay.
I did this in 2024, and I received over 104,000 votes, for which I'm grateful and building upon now.
Well, you have done a great job of having us run out of time, but I really appreciated speaking with you.
Thank you, Lloyd.
And you certainly are energetic, if nothing else. Let's pretend for a minute. You get elected.
Yes, sir.
And so now we have Congresswoman or Congressperson, whatever you prefer, Beth Farnham from Adams County, the new congressman. What would be the first thing you do?
I would first honor my oath to the U.S. Constitution. That means upholding and supporting the U.S. Constitution. That's absolute number one. And that means pursuing those who have violated the U.S. Constitution. We are looking at a presidential administration that has been sued hundreds of times. There are hundreds of lawsuits right now because he is violating our U.S. Constitution.
Do you feel he's more important than the congressional district?
Yes, because he's a Russian asset. Our national security is...
So you really believe that the President of the United States is more important for your attention than the people that live in the district?
He is a threat to our national security. This is absolute number one. I love my country deeply. It absolutely means everything to me that he does not continue to run amok. He is impounding illegally funding to important programs. He is trading secrets, grifting, defying the emoluments clause. He cannot continue to lead this country. And again, sending masked agents of the state out to persecute people without due process. It is unconscionable that we have continued this. So he has to be stopped. The revolutionary founders of this country gave us the impeachment gift as a clause. They knew that sometimes the wrong person might be in the office, and that is their nonviolent gift to us to remedy the situation.
Beth Farnham, thank you very much for joining us. You've certainly been different, and we've enjoyed speaking with you. We want to thank our guest, Beth Farnham, who is the Democratic candidate of the Congress of the United States in the 13th District. This morning program is brought to you as a public service by the Bedford County Development Association, BCDA, presenting the Bedford County Advantage, a future built on opportunity, collaboration, and exceptional quality of life that defines our region. To learn more, visit bcda.org. This is Lloyd Roach. See you next Saturday. Until then, have a great week.
You have been listening to Bedford County Speaks over 98.7 FM and 1310 AM WBFD. The show is heard right here every Saturday at 8:30 AM. If you'd like to hear the program again, visit bedfordcountyspeaks.com. Join us next time for Bedford County Speaks.